whatever. I can just take this number. That's going to fit for me the value, say, of the mass. Or if it's lambda phi 4, it's going to fit for me the value of the coupling in lambda phi 4. So in some sense, that's just something that, you know, assuming fluctuations can be small, that's just something that you fit and you use to fit the parameters in your model. So in some sense, this is the more interesting number, this deviation from scale invariance. So before we get into the really nitty-gritty calculation, I want to give you some, we can already get some intuition about what this measurement actually means. Okay? So let's ask about scale invariant. Okay. So you've been calculating with Andrew, and this is probably a few lectures back, right? But you've been calculating essentially the power spectrum, right? The amplitude of fluctuations for a scalar field in an exact De Sitter background. And what you calculated with him, let me make sure I use the same notation so it matches. So you've calculated P of K for massless scalar field in a fixed De Sitter background. And what you calculated was the two-point correlation, which you were also calling the Whiteman function. And assuming that you're using the Bunch-Davies vacuum, which we're always going to assume from now on, you looked at the correlation of the field x at some now conformal time eta, and the field at a different point y, in principle at some different time eta prime, but let me take the equal time correlators. So let me have that be the same eta. So let's say here it's equal time. Again with Bunch-Davies here, right? And what did you get? Well, you got something very simple. If we write it in the notation of this power spectrum, E3k, 2 pi cubed, what you found for the power spectrum was essentially h squared over 2k cubed, right? And then, of course, there's e to the I k x minus y. So that's essentially exactly what we were just writing down sort of qualitatively for any of the two-point functions, right? And we said when x was equal to y, basically we turned this into the sine, and all we had left for the power spectrum was this guy. So in this, you know, with the two pi's to get delta, okay? And this thing is scale invariant, right? That was the big point from before. There's 3k's here, there's 3k's here. And you can make a shift sort of in the wave number. K goes to lambda times k. Corresponding shift x goes to x over lambda, right? And essentially you get back the same thing. Okay, so this was scale invariant. We can do something just slightly more complicated, okay? So one thing at a time. And let's give the field a mass. But let's still work in the regime where we want essentially a fixed De Sitter background. Okay? So in other words, we assume that the potential is some V naught. This V naught is what was generating, for example, your H here, like a cosmological constant. If we add this scalar field term, m squared phi squared, basically the biggest we can take phi is something like m Planck squared, right? So if we still want this to be a really small correction, we want this to be basically V naught, then we want that 1/2 m squared, and let's put m Planck squared here, right? Because that's sort of the maximum field value we can imagine, order of magnitude. We want this thing to be much, much less than V naught. Well, V naught, if that's sourcing our De Sitter, that's 3 h squared m Planck squared. So roughly, we want to work in the regime where m squared is much, much less than h squared. Okay. And then a lot of our intuition is just going to go through, right? Basically, you can, yeah.
So V naught is the cosmological constant?
Yeah. So basically, before we had this exact De Sitter, so let's take this guy to be the source of that exact De Sitter. Okay. So then what you can do is you can go back and you can go through the same procedure that you went through with Andrew. We're just going to add a little mass, and we're going to see what happens to our power spectrum. Okay? So what I want to do basically is I'm going to use the same, hopefully what's the same notation, if I've correctly figured out what his notation was. So we're always going to still talk about the canonical field, right? And this is going to be modes for UK, which is the scalar field with the scale factor divided out, A of eta. And we're still going to assume that we've decomposed the field as before. So if I write U of conformal time eta and position x, right, this was a sum we had basically positive and negative frequency modes. We had creation operators and annihilation operators. So let's do the same thing. U of the I, k dot x goes with uk of eta, goes with the operator ak, and the opposite term, minus ik dot x, uk of eta star, ak dagger. And again, we're going to say that basically these AKs on the bunch Davies vacuum are zeros. Okay. So what you did before, you wrote down the action for the scalar field with the gravitational term. You wrote down the equation of motion. You took a Fourier transform. It was quadratic, so all the modes were separate. And you were left with a mode equation that you had to solve for these, basically to find these UK. Sorry, the Einstein-Hilbert term in the action. Yeah. Right, so you started with the action, you got the equation of motion, you quantized the field, you wrote it in terms of Fourier space modes, and you found a solution for what these UK were for the massless field. So if we add the mass term, you can do all of those steps again. You can see that all that's going to happen is your solution for the modes now is just going to have some mass squared appearing in it. And you get an equation of motion, basically, that's going to tell you that eta squared U prime prime. What you had before was a k squared eta squared minus 2. And now all you're going to have is a new term, m squared over h squared. Times u k equals 0. Okay? So all the small corrections that we're going to put in, here we just added a mass. I could have also actually made a small deviation in the fact that h was constant. All these small corrections we're going to put in, essentially, as long as they're not big corrections, just add new constants here. And adding new constants here doesn't change the form of this equation, right? This is still a form of Bessel's equation. So the solutions are still going to have, functionally, the same form that you already solved for. So this is still Bessel's equation. And so you know what the solutions are. Can I still write here? One more line down? Maybe it's getting too low for you to move. So a generic solution to this is going to be uk of eta. There's an eta to the 1/2 right in front. And then these are just Bessel functions of either kind. So let's put some constant, c1. And I'll tell you what nu is in a minute. It could be j nu of k eta. Some other constant, c2. Other type of Bessel function, y nu of minus k eta. Okay? And nu, before, was 3/2. Now it's corrected by the mass term. So it's the square root of 9/4 minus m squared over h squared. Or since we're working in the regime where this term is really small, this is just 3/2 minus m squared over 3h squared. Okay. And now if you look at these functions in the limit of high frequency modes, So you take out, you expand them for large k eta here. You can find this, the value of these coefficients that gives you the Bunch Davies vacuum. So you're looking for what's the definition of positive frequency modes, okay? And you find that Bunch Davies corresponds to taking C1 equals 1 roughly. There's going to be a normalization of some root pi over 2, and C2 equals I. And that's just a Hankel function. So in fact, because of this business of looking for positive and negative frequency modes, people often actually, instead of writing the Bessel functions here, they already write the Hankel functions, which are combinations of these guys with I plus or minus 1, because it's much more obvious than what, sort of in a sense, what your vacuum looks like for the choice that you make. and so we can write the full solution. And I'm going to put the normalization back in. And you can basically expand this Hankel function if you want to check that this agrees with what you got before in the massless limit and take the mass to 0. Factor of Hubble. There's a factor of the conformal time. This is a Hankel function of the first kind minus k. So usually when you see solutions written down for generic inflationary solutions or whatever, they're actually written like this, h nu. And nu is meant to be 3 halves up to modifications by things like masses and maybe some slow roll correction here. Okay. So the point is that we can actually look at this in the limit where we look at modes that are outside the horizon, right? So we sort of know that there's this difference in behavior of the modes when they're inside the horizon and they're oscillating. And then they get stretched outside the horizon, and the mode, the behavior changes. And essentially, it's that outside the horizon behavior that, that we're going to be interested in, that we're going to match onto for inflation. So let's look at what this guy looks like in that limit. So let me write now phi k. Oops. And in fact, you know what? I had already taken the extra eta here, so this was phi k. I'm sorry. Right. There was a difference in a between phi and u, and I'd already put it in there. So if I look at phi k in this limit, so this is the super horizon modes, right? So k is very large, so this is much less than 1. Sorry, k, the wavelength is very large, so k is very small. So the form that we have here is not, it's not actually the standard. You have to rearrange it a little bit to get the standard form. So it might not look completely familiar to you, right? And depends. I think you have to take into account these etas. It's a few. I'm sorry. It's a few lines, but yeah. I'm sorry. I'm doing this a bit quickly because essentially this is the only modification. So you can go back and repeat all the steps if you like. This is the only modification here, and I'm just doing it so that we can compare the result that we get here to the previous scale invariant case. Yeah.
So the first h there is the Hubble constant.
That's right, that's right. This guy's a Hankel function. Yeah, anything else? Sorry, it's a lot of notation suddenly, so let's make sure it's all right. Okay, so in this limit, you can just look up what the expression for this guy is when the argument here is large. And basically, you find there's an h still. There's an eta to the 3 halves still. All the coefficients end up just giving you a root 2. And you're left with minus k eta. And I guess I need to find it's 2 u squared over 3h squared. Sometimes people call this combination delta. Sometimes people write this as 3 halves minus delta, which is just a small parameter, right? So in this case, it was m squared over h squared. But in general, it could be something a bit more complicated. But it's some small correction, and then that delta goes there. Okay? So the interesting thing about this is that in some sense, it's still scale invariant, right? Because here, when you were doing the scaling before, remember when you wrote the form of the De Sitter metric, so you had a 1 over I squared eta squared out in front. If I scale k, I'm also scaling eta. So combinations of k eta are still scalar invariant. So in some sense, I added a mass here. As long as I kept h exactly constant, what I get for the power spectrum is just the square of this. All right, and that's still scalar invariant. So there's going to be the k cubed as usual, all that normal stuff. And there's this guy. You know what? I dropped the 3, didn't I? Yeah.
There's still that path to the 3 house.
Yeah, exactly. There's the k cubed, which is actually missing the k to the 3 house. Yeah, sorry. Good, thanks. That's right. So this is the correction for this guy. Thanks. Okay, so basically, what we're finding is that we can make small corrections to the calculation we already did to get something, oops, I erased it, for that spectral index that wasn't exactly scale invariant. What we need to do is we need to make h not exactly constant. Okay? That's where sort of the trick comes in. So scale dependence for inflationary p of k is up to a special fine-tuning double C, but is essentially h dot not equal to 0. And this is actually what people take to be, in some ways, a compelling sign of the inflationary scenario that we wrote down. And so I'm going to explain to you quickly why that is. Okay. So you might argue, you might say, well, wait a minute. This almost looks like that pivot point if I choose some special conformal time to put here, right? But the point is I have to choose a special time. I have to basically break that exact De Sitter invariance. I have to choose a time of inflation ending or beginning, some physically relevant time. I have exact De Sitter space. Even for a massless field, there is no physically relevant time, right? All times are the same. So that's the point here. So really what makes a difference for these modes and what makes them scale dependent is that there is a special time. There's a special time when inflation ends, if you like, which sets a special point, and then how things change away from that, how things scale, is what gives you scale dependence. And now what we're going to see is, of course, I could put in that special point and still try to maintain scale invariance, but that's not going to work either. Okay, that's the one loophole. So let's see why that is. Yeah.
So the scale invariance of that is if I replace k by lambda k.
Yeah.
I replace eta by lambda.
Yeah, exactly.
Then the thing in the bracket remains invariant.
Exactly.
And but the prefactor doesn't.
That's right. But when I look at the integral, the power spectrum, right, then this is the scale invariance we had before. Yeah, thanks. So if you want to check this, you can go back to when you wrote the form of the De Sitter metric in the form where you pulled out h squared, eta squared, whatever, and you can see why eta has to scale as well. Yeah. Yeah, thanks. That was a bit. So if I continued here and written p of k for p of k, that would have been true. Okay. So this seems to be true. There's a possible loophole to what I'm saying. And that was this original idea of old inflation. So the fact that we're going to see that this loophole doesn't work is why this measurement, that measurement that ns minus 1 is not exactly 1, many people took to be the first sort of, you know, convincing indication that inflation was right. Okay. So what's a loophole? Well, I could make a system that looks like this. Suppose I write v of phi. And basically, I try to write a potential that looks basically what we had right there, right? I want it to be essentially constant. Here's a constant. We said I could choose a special point to break the symmetry, and that point is going to be where inflation ends. So let me put a barrier, right? And let me have the rest of the potential tunnel out to something with like a very small cosmological constant, like today, okay? So the field is going to sit here at this exactly symmetric point, and then at some point it's going to tunnel out. Okay, so here it would be exact scale invariance, right? There's nothing special about this point. Everything's the same as long as inflation lasts until suddenly inflation ends. So this would, in some sense, this would be scale invariant. Okay, so can we do this? Okay, well, the thing that we need to imagine is, while the field is sitting here, right, the whole space is inflating, a little tunneling event can happen locally, which means a little region of space now is sitting in a bubble that has this vacuum energy instead of this vacuum energy. Okay, it can happen over here, it can happen over here, it can happen over here. So most of the space is at V0, but we can get these little bubbles. Okay? And because we want, essentially, the field to go exactly to this minimum, right, it's going to sit at this most symmetric point. The configuration is going to be completely symmetric. Inside, the thing is, again, static with this value of the energy, vacuum energy. So the only thing that happens is that all of the energy difference between here and here goes into these bubbles expanding, goes into kinetic energy of the bubble walls. Okay, so these bubble walls are expanding. So delta E, the difference in these energies, is kinetic energy. The bubble walls, but the interior is a cold, right, empty space, essentially, of this energy. All right. So now the problem is we don't want the end of inflation to be a cold, empty space, right? We want the end of inflation to somehow transfer energy from the inflationary scenario into normal particles. So how can that happen? The only way that can happen in this scenario is for these bubbles to collide. So reheat is just this word for transfer energy. To, say, standard model particles. All right. So you can do a complicated calculation here, but you can also just do a simple calculation, and you can say, well, let me ask for the rate, so the number of bubbles produced per volume per time. The only rate, or the only time scale, length scale in the problem is h, so we ask for gamma over h to the 4. So how many bubbles do I produce? You can see that the bubbles are expanding at the speed of light in the simplest thing, but the space is also expanding, right? So clearly, if I don't nucleate enough bubbles in one Hubble time, in one volume, to find each other, they're never going to find each other, right? So basically, gamma over h to the 4 is too small. Bubbles never collide. If you bump this number up so that it's big enough, gamma over h to the 4 bigger than 1, basically you don't sit in the false vacuum long enough to get inflation, to get enough inflation. Not enough inflation. So that scenario doesn't work. And that's the reason why, essentially, people went to this picture, where originally they had a false vacuum, they had a tunneling, they had slow roll, they had a fall off the hill, right? And they glued everything together. And nowadays, for the most part, people just forget that initial part and just assume that we start here. Yeah, that doesn't really tell you anything, because you still haven't answered the question of how did you get here and all that, but that's the scenario that people have in mind. Do you have a question?
So when you're doing this picture with the bubbles and stuff, are you talking about that model where you have like basically this infinite space and then the universes are bubbles inside? So
the question is this picture an infinite space in the universe? Are these individual bubbles? So it could be in some sense, right? Because these bubbles continue to expand. If they get big enough that they contain the universe, they contain the universe. But the problem is that to make this look like our universe, the bubbles shouldn't get big enough. You have to have a lot of bubble collisions, right? So a lot of bubbles have to meet within the size of our universe to heat things up, which also doesn't work then because you don't get enough inflation. But this basic picture where people imagine a landscape and they imagine, you know, that the classical potential energy has many sort of vacua, many minima, and that you can tunnel between them and create universes. Indeed, some people like to imagine that you know, the start of this whole thing actually is some tunneling event which starts the creation of our universe, and things go on. So people often glue that whole picture onto the beginning of this picture, which is in some ways one of the reasons that inflation is confusing, because you're starting to get into these all eternal, you know, questions of infinities. How do you count what's likely and what's not likely? But for the time being, this was just a picture to get just our universe. But in that sense, it doesn't work.
Yeah. So is the current picture that the universe flattened everywhere the same at the same time, or is it also with bubbles colliding?
So the question is, did the universe inflate everywhere at the same time, or is it bubble collisions? Yeah. So I'm repeating the question because I realize when you listen to the video, you often can't hear the question. So if by the entire universe you mean the observable universe, the visible universe, then the current picture is that for the visible universe, we have this slow roll story of inflation. So the space, like we said, to get the number of e-folds right, we're claiming that the whole space that we see, and in fact, a much vaster space just by inflation, actually came from this slow roll period, and the whole thing was in that period at the same time. Now, that's not maybe completely satisfactory because you don't know if that's consistent with what came before and all that, but that's the best we can do at the moment, yeah. So the upshot of all this is that H dot not being zero is actually really important, and the measurement of that is what people took to be the first evidence of inflation. Okay. I think, I need to say a couple more things, actually. Okay. So actually, this point, H dot not equals zero, we can actually go a little bit farther and see a couple more qualitative features. So the reason for doing all this is that the hard calculation that we're going to get to is basically the same no matter what you do. It's a hard calculation, it's a long calculation. But the most important thing is basically to know what are the qualitatively important features of that solution, okay? And one of them is going to be H dot not equals zero, and what can be the sign of H dot, for example. So let's look at that. Okay, so H dot not equals zero. But we can say more. So let's go back to the standard scalar field picture. So let's basically assume that because we have a scalar field sourcing inflation, and because we're inflating away gradient energies, we're just going to take a perfect fluid. So we have an energy density to worry about, and we have a pressure to worry about. And let's look at the information that we have in the Einstein equations. So this is going to encompass all our scalar field models. So the Friedman equations, which are really just the Einstein equations. All right, so what do we have? The 0-0 equation, which is sometimes called the first Friedman equation. That we know, right? 3m Planck squared h squared is equal to rho. In terms of our scalar field, that was 1/2 phi dot squared plus v of phi. The diagonal component of the spatial part, right? You have three equations that are essentially the same for the pressure. And that gives us the second derivative, 2a dot dot over a, right? This is the first derivative of the scalar factor. This has the second derivative, plus h squared is equal to minus the pressure. So hopefully my p's and my rho's are different. It's a rho, that's a p, with m Planck squared here. Okay? So we can actually combine these two expressions to find an expression for H dot in terms of P and rho. Okay, so what is H dot? Well, H is A dot over A, so we've got an A dot dot over A minus A dot squared over A squared, right? So A dot dot over A minus H squared. So you can see we can combine these and get an expression for this. So combining 0, 0 and II equations, we can find that 2 E dot dot over A. So I think I'm just going to add one of each. In fact, I think that'll get me there. Yep, let's just add this to this. So we've got h squared minus 3h squared, so I've got to move the m Planck squared over from this equation, this side to this side, to just add them. But what I get then is this is just equal to minus rho plus p over m Planck squared. And this thing is actually just 2 times h dot, right? H squareds combine. So I find 2 h dot is equal to minus rho plus p over m Planck squared. But we know from applying the null energy condition to this fluid, and I think this was reviewed to you probably in the GR class, that actually rho plus p is greater than or equal to 0. If that's true, we find that the null energy condition tells us that h dot is less than or equal to 0. That's good, right? Because basically, h dot with that sign, if this is the potential energy, means I'm going down the potential. So classically rolling down the potential is what corresponds to h dot less than 0. Yeah?
Can you remind us heuristically what the meaning of the null energy condition? Just very briefly.
She didn't mention it at all.
No, neither did Latham.
And neither did Latham?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, we can do it some other time.
Yeah, maybe yeah. Since maybe I should check what you know for background and then give you a three-line derivation that will make sense, probably. Yeah, sorry about that. I assumed that was one of the things that was covered. Let's start this guy. I guess probably what you do know, I'm not sure what frame you might know, but you probably do know that most of the matter that we're familiar with, except things like Casimir energy and quantum back reactions, so except for quantum, essentially quantum effects, everybody obeys this null energy condition. So there are very special, there are a few very special cases of weird isolated things in string theory, but mostly it's quantum effects that actually violate that. So the basic upshot of this equation is that there are ways to get alternatives to inflation which do similar things but which have the sign of this guy reversed. And in many cases, you have to be careful with those because, you know, somewhere in there has to be a null energy condition violation. Now, that can be okay, but it's a quantum effect or it's a special energy source effect. So this condition, this reasonableness condition, especially when applied to gravitational waves where it's a precise statement about what the spectrum looks like, is a way to distinguish between the full class of models that we're considering here and some alternatives to inflation, actually. And those can be fine or not, but you know there's a little bit of an interesting trick you have to do there with the way you source inflation, which is not the way you source scalar field inflation. Yeah. Yeah. Next time I'll try to find what you know and give you a good picture. Okay. Okay. So for the scalar field, you can see right away that this is okay, actually. Because we know what the energy density and the pressure are actually given by. Also, we can just add these two things and find what the other side of the equation is. And basically, we find that, right, the energy density is the sum of the kinetic and the potential. The pressure is the difference of those two. When I add these things together, the only thing that's left is phi dot squared. So for a scalar field, this is okay, since basically the sum of these two guys is just phi dot squared over m Planck squared. This is positive, this is negative, so we're all okay. Yeah, and for cosmology, especially for inflation, you basically only need to understand this condition for fluid. So I think I'll just talk about fluids for it. Okay. Okay, so actually, this criteria suggests a different way of defining the slow roll parameter, which is somehow getting to the essence of what it means to be non-scale invariant and what it means to be inflating. So this suggests that we define again, epsilon, and it's not going to matter because it turns out it's essentially the same thing. But let me put a little h here. So I'm defining it only in terms of the behavior of the Hubble parameter and not in terms of the behavior of the potential. Let's say epsilon h is minus h dot over h squared. And for slow roll, you can check that this is essentially matches the definition that we had before. So this is basically the same thing, over 2 v prime over v squared. But in some ways, this is nicer because it's just talking about how h evolves, right? It's a bit independent of the details of how we source inflation. And actually, we can directly see that the criteria of what epsilon should be is really, really obvious here. So we got back to the question of should epsilon be less than 1 or should it be much less than 1. So here, if we go back to the expression for a double dot, which I guess I have down there, if I just write the equation for a double dot, right, and we know accelerated expansion is a double dot greater than 0, I can rearrange that equation there to give myself an h squared and an h dot squared on the same side of the equation. So I'm going to rearrange this guy. Then I've got a double dot over a is equal to h dot plus h squared. I can take out an h squared from both sides, or both pieces, and I've got a 1 minus epsilon, right? So a double dot greater than 0 implies epsilon h less than 1. So that's just basically the same criteria we had before. Okay, so we're going to be looking at properties of the solution for the fluctuations, but as we go and in the homework, you're going to try to think qualitatively about what all these conditions actually mean for the solution. Okay. All right. So now, let's do the fluctuations. So we know that what we want to do is actually divide phi. So this is the inflaton that's sourcing h, and it's going to generate the spectrum of fluctuations for us. We want to divide it up into a background piece that's homogeneous in space, right? So this is the whole space is going to follow the same evolution of the Hubble parameter. So this is only a function of t. And we're going to add to it fluctuation delta phi, which is a function of x and t. Now the point, the hope is that, you know, we know that to get the evolution of the Hubble parameter from this, we plugged into the Einstein equations and solved. So now we're going to plug the whole thing into the Einstein equation. We want to solve for the background and the perturbation, right? Which means that we have to perturb the metric. And that's where we have to start being careful, right? Because if we make coordinate transformations, that can look, from the point of view of the fluctuations, like having a fluctuation or not having a fluctuation. So how we choose, essentially, to choose a time direction, to sort of slice the space into equal time slices, is going to affect what looks like a perturbation and doesn't. So we have to be careful that we choose a slicing that matches what we want to get out at the end of inflation. So it matches the surface on which inflation ends, and that we get a variable that we can actually track through this whole evolution procedure, and where fluctuations remain small. So we couldn't choose a slicing, evolve perturbations, and find that perturbations become large. Then we'd be in trouble, right? We'd have to choose a new slicing that somehow incorporated those into the background. So one of the issues here is we know observationally that the net curvature fluctuation is small, But we have to be careful. To define the background. Such that that's always true. Now, in most simple cases for slow roll inflation, it's not going to matter very much, but you know the fluctuation blowing up often just means that you can redefine it into the background and sort of start again. But that's always the issue that we have with fluctuations of the metric. Okay. So even if that's not true, even if fluctuations are always small in you know whatever time slicing we choose, so even if fluctuations remain small, the choice of coordinates matters. So for example, one very natural variable to follow as we follow the inflationary story is to follow surfaces of constant density, right? That's a constant value of the scalar field, essentially. So if I'm really taking the scalar field as my clock, then phi is, you know, a value of the scalar field is a position, is a time along my inflationary trajectory. And for the most part, we think inflation ends at a particular value of phi, which is a particular value of the density. So inflation ends on equal density surfaces. So you might want to follow, so a natural choice follow the density rho as a function of time. So now we're choosing constant density surfaces, right? So this could have been rho of x and t, but let's just follow constant density surfaces, so these are rho of t. And we know that at the end of inflation, we're somehow interested in perturbations of the gravitational field, right? So it's not clear that those two are going to be the same thing, constant density surfaces and constant curvature surfaces, for example, right? Probably not. So we need to be careful about what happens to change of coordinates. And we can immediately see that there's an issue . So suppose I define t tilde, which is t plus delta t of x, t. But basically, essentially, the position dependence matters. So if I look at my constant density surface, and I want to now somehow map to something that's constant curvature, then at different points in that space, I might have to move by different amounts to get to a surface that's, say, flat. Okay? So you might imagine that you have a space-dependent coordinate redefinition that you want to do to look at some other physically important quantity. And you can probably easily imagine that if you do that, it's not clear that you know you're moving away from the constant density surface by a different value at different points in space. So clearly what's left over is not going to be a constant density surface anymore, right? It's going to have perturbations on it. So you can see that just by plugging in for rho of t and taking the Fourier taking the Taylor expansion. So basically rho of t is the same thing as rho of t tilde minus delta t position x, which is, if we assume it's a small transformation, that's just rho of t tilde minus delta t d rho t tilde now. But t, at this order, t is t tilde. Okay. So now now we have density perturbations, basically. So we have to be very, very clear on what we're tracking. Yeah.
So I'm very confused, sorry. Not an expert on perturbation theory. So we are actually dealing with Einstein's equation here. But instead of looking at how the matter is constant over hypersurfaces.
Yes.
And for that, we need to consider the full set of Einstein's equations.
Yeah. Yeah. So I haven't basically What we actually need to do is we need to track the evolution of the metric, which is a tensor. And this here I'm just tracking the evolution of a scalar, right, which is the density. So we have a lot more work to do, but this sort of illustrates the problem. And especially for inflation where there are several clear choices of constant density or constant curvature surfaces, then we're going to have to learn what that means for the full spectrum of fluctuations and the full Einstein equations.
This is something that is already in the full Einstein equation.
Exactly, exactly. So what we want to do are separate out the Hubble evolution from the fluctuations and the density which source the evolutions and the curvature. But of course, those things are mixed up with each other, essentially, and that's what we're going to have to try to untangle. And we know how in general GR should behave under coordinate transformations, right? And so that's why you can see that knowing that when we make coordinate transformations here, we sort of change what the meaning of the perturbation was. You know, we better see what that does to the gravitational tensor. Okay. So really, we also want to write p mu nu, some background, plus some fluctuation. And this, we know we want to be our FRW space, our quasi-de Sitter space, right? So this thing, we know, if we write it in, let's choose our coordinates over here. So let's go with ds squared is minus dt squared. Well, let me see what I want to work in, actually. Probably I want to use conformal time. Yeah, let's do this. The minus in there was the x squared. So let's write this guy as minus a squared. So the background is diagonal. When we do this, the spectrum of fluctuations, and it's basically diagonal because there's a symmetry, right? It's diagonal because we want it to be FRW. But the fluctuations can be everywhere, right? We have to solve for what the fluctuations are doing. So we can't just perturb along a diagonal and expect to get the full answer, okay? Perturbations on the off-diagonal are, in fact, going to tell us something about what kind of matter we have. So fluctuations or perturbations can be everywhere, generically. Can be, let's say, in all components. So we need to find a way to write an ansatz for our metric that captures all of those possible fluctuations. So let's do that here. And I'll write it in several different lines. So we're pulling out this background a squared everywhere, okay? So then I'm going to add some factors of 2 just for convenience, right? Factors of 2 basically because there's a square here. Let me make sure. So there are lots of different conventions for the signs and for the symbols that go here. So let me try to be consistent. Let's put 1 plus 2. Okay, so this is going to be annoying. For a minute, I'm going to have another phi, okay, phi symbol, because that's a very common symbol for the gravitational potential. But for my scalar field, I'm always going to have phi naught for the background and delta phi for the fluctuation, okay? So this little phi that's going to sit here in the metric fluctuation is going to be annoying potentially, but we're always going to track when it's the metric and when it's not, and then it's going to disappear. So, okay. So this can be by dt squared. Then in general, I didn't have off-diagonal components before, right? But now I can have off-diagonal fluctuations. So let's call those guys omega. I can have them in each, these are vectors in each of the spatial directions together with the time direction. So here's a d eta and a dxi. Thank you. D squared. Great. And then I have the terms that are just the spatial terms, right? The x, I, j terms. And here I sort of, you know, separated off a scalar and a vector part. So similarly for the piece that's the complete scalar part, this is still a tensor, right? I'm going to divide it up into some different components. And I'm going to call the scalar part psi. That's going to have a delta ij. And then what's left over, I'm going to call hij. This multiplies dxi, dxj. And because I've essentially already taken out this scalar here, there's a condition on this guy, right, so that I don't have an extra. I'm not overcounting, basically. And the condition there is that this be traceless. So I had a lot of freedom in how I put in these components, right? But I chose a particular way, basically, because it treated the time slightly different from the spatial part, which is what's captured in my energy momentum tensor, so that's going to be nice. And where was I going with that? And basically we'll see that that's a convenient representation. And you can check that we didn't overdo it by counting the degrees of freedom, right?
Yeah.
So what's psi here? That's just a scalar part. So it would be the trace if I had taken the full three-dimensional spatial tensor that's left over. It's the trace of that. So I've just taken it out because it's a scalar. So part of the reason for this being standard is that separating out scalar parts from vector parts from tensor parts at first order in cosmological perturbation theory is very nice because those things effectively don't couple. And so you can talk separately about the spatial fluctuations, the scalar fluctuations, so of our field, and the scalar parts of the metric, separately about the vector perturbations and separately about the tensor perturbations. That's very convenient because physically we know we have this scalar degree of freedom. The tensor part is going to be the gravitational wave part, and the vector part is actually just going to essentially be inflated away. It's going to disappear. Yeah?
And the phi is not a perturbation, scalar perturbation?
So it is a scalar perturbation, it's not the scalar field. Thanks.
So when you say scalar perturbation, you mean phi and psi?
Yeah, I mean the stuff with no indices, essentially. Okay. So we can just count that we did it right, right? So we know that the metric has four components. We know it's symmetric. It has 10 degrees of freedom. So we can count that we now have 10 perturbation degrees of freedom here, which is how many we should have. And then we know that it's not redundant. Okay. So let's do that. I guess let me leave that. So naively, we should have 10. And we've got scalars, vectors, and tensors, right? OK, so what did I have for scalars? I had psi, and I had phi. 2, good. What did I have here? Omega I, right? There were 3 spatial indices, basically. And there's no special restriction on that guy. So he's got 3. And then I had hij. And this would be 3 by 3 and symmetric, right? So let's see. 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. And symmetric. 3, 4, 5, 6. So I would have 6. But I said I took out the trace, right? So I have 6 minus 1. So that's our full set of perturbations we need to consider. Now, it's going to turn out that not all of those, for the coordinate transformation reasons we just talked about, not all of those are physical. And so we're actually going to have an even simpler system. Okay? Okay, good. So you can do a further decomposition to even pull out more scalar parts, right? And essentially, you can do that because you can divide a generic vector and a generic tensor. You can decompose it even more, right? And so we can pull out even more scalars. So Yeah, let's do that just really quickly, actually, and then we'll stop there. Because then we'll really have the set of scalar, the full set of scalars that we're actually going to work with. So we can do further decomposition. And basically write this vector omega that we have, these omega I's, as a longitudinal part and a transverse part. So let's call those omega perpendicular and omega parallel. And basically, these are separated by the fact of whether it's their curl or their gradient that's zero, right? Okay? And for this one, since the curl is zero, then I know I can actually write that as a gradient of a scalar. So we're fishing out another scalar from there. So this one I can write as gradient B, where this is a scalar. And similarly for this hij, the only thing that's going to matter basically is, sorry?
Do you mean that grad of B is omega parallel?
Yes, sorry. Implies. Thanks. There we go. And the only thing that's actually going to matter for our discussion of scalar fluctuations is that we can pull out one scalar degree of freedom here, too. Okay? So you can pull out additional vectors, additional scalars, and you can simplify your tensor so that it's transverse and traceless. Okay? So completely, people call this, there are names for all these guys. So again, you have the longitudinal part, like this. Again, you have the transverse part, little h, sorry. But then you've got an extra component, which is sometimes called the solenoidal part. Let's call it solenoidal. And you can further write this then as scalars, vectors, and an actual tensor. So the common way to do this is to call this 2 times a scalar E. And then there are vector parts. Right? You can see there's basically 2 ways to get a vector with 2 indices, di, fj, or dj, fi. It has to be symmetric. So those are the vector parts. And then there's a little baby tensor left over. Let's call it h tilde ij. And this leftover tensor is now traceless and transverse. So we're going to come back to the tensor part later, so let's not worry too much about that. The vectors we won't ever have to worry about very much. The thing we need for now is that we got another scalar E out of this. So basically, we still have the same number of degrees of freedom, but we took some pieces out of here and here to get 4 scalars that we're going to actually deal with when we perturb the metric. Okay. So what we're going to do next time is start with just the scalar pieces of this long ansatz for the metric. And we're going to see what happens when we make coordinate transformations, because we're going to see that some of those degrees of freedom are going to disappear when we ask that everything be invariant under coordinate transformations. Yeah?
So, I mean, I'm a bit confused. When you say scalar, when you say scalar or vector,
yeah,
we are implicitly thinking of some group of transformations.
That's right. That's right.
And when we look at that, I'm thinking local S03 or O3, right? Is this the same group that we're thinking about?
So the full set of components has to have, of course, all of those components together have to have the full transformation, as this guy did. but let's see how to say this. So I guess part of the problem is that hidden in here is a degree of freedom that's going to get mixed up with delta phi. And so the way to see sort of what that degree of freedom is to see if I can pull out somebody with no index, right? If I can act with 1 derivative or 2 derivatives to get out that piece, right? That has it. But in doing that, then of course I change the condition on the full group that this guy transforms under, and basically then I just get some condition on 1 derivative or 2 derivatives of him. Yeah. So Yeah, so you can work out, you can go through and work out exactly how this works under symmetry transformations. For this purpose, it's actually easier just to count indices and to say, can I take out something with no indices? And then if I do that, what's the consistent thing that has to be left over such that I still have the full transformation?
I mean, I guess our space-time has a kind of a 1 plus 3 kind of decomposition.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, that's the reason that we treated this one different from this one to begin with, and we chose how to do the 3 by 3 versus the diagonal component. Yeah. Okay, anything else about all that? You guys have seen the ADM formalism? You have seen that. Okay, that's good. Because that sort of follows the same decomposition. Have you seen...
Radiant mass.
I think it's so important to actually, I think we are seeing again in the microcontrollers.
Okay. Okay, but so it's only people that are really taking the numerical relativity that probably have done a calculation with. Well, okay, we'll see. How about gauge transformations in general in GR? Did you guys do that in the GR course? Okay, good. So at least some of this should be. Okay, all right. I'll have a look at what those courses covered and then make sure. Okay, thanks.
We've got to run out. 3 minutes.